I work at La Paz Hospital in Madrid, in Spain. On behalf of my co-chair, Joel Galán from Johns Hopkins University, let me welcome all of you to this non-ASTRA-driven session entitled Double-Edged Sword, Long-Term Complications of Antiretroviral Therapy and HIV. So as I said, this is a non-ASTRA-driven section. We have four different speakers for four different, very different topics. Each presentation will last around 15 minutes, and then we will take questions from the audience. The first speaker is Dr. Patrick Mallon. Dr. Mallon is an infectious diseases specialist at the Mater Misericordiae University Hospital in Dublin, and a lecturer in medicine at University College in Dublin. He heads the HIV Molecular Research Group at UCD, and his research areas include lipid metabolism, cardiovascular disease, and bone disease in HIV, treatment of HIV-infected injecting drug users, and models of care delivery in a special population. The title of his talk is Bones of Contention, HIV and Bone Disease. Paddy?
Thanks very much. Thanks for the very kind. I'd like to thank the conference organizers for the very kind invitation to talk about HIV and bone disease. When I received the title of the presentation that I was to give, Bones of Contention, I quickly realized that it wouldn't be difficult to fill a 15-minute presentation, as there are many contentious issues within this research field. What I've decided to do is to concentrate on five main questions over the next 15 minutes. The first, is low BMD more common in HIV-infected patients? Are fractures more common in HIV-infected patients? What's the best measure when we look at measuring BMD in our patients? Should we be using the T-score or the Z-score? What are the relevant contributions of antiretroviral therapy, body mass index, and vitamin D to the low BMD that we see in our patients, and which patients should be screened? So to start off with, the first question, is low BMD more common in HIV? I think the unequivocal answer is yes. We now have a wealth of data that is from various populations from around the world that consistently shows very high rates of low BMD in HIV-infected patients. These data as far back as 2006 were nicely summarized by Todd Brown in his AIDS paper. In this paper, he summarized the cohorts that have been presented to date that examined BMD in both HIV-positive and HIV-negative groups. What this data clearly shows is not only across all studies that the prevalence of low BMD is much higher in the HIV-positive groups versus the HIV-negative groups, but that the prevalence rates are quite consistent across studies, with the exception of one study, prevalence rates of low BMD in excess of 50% within the population studied, which is striking when you consider the very varied demographics of the different populations and the variety of countries from which these populations have been derived. And you will notice, in addition to conferences such as this, where there are further examples of these types of cross-sectional studies presented, that the consistent rates of low BMD are prevalent even as time goes by and as antiretroviral treatment regimes change. We're also starting to get some information in terms of progression of bone mineral density. At the Retrovirus Conference earlier this year, a Spanish study of 391 patients demonstrated that over a follow-up period of 2.5 years, more than 12% of patients progressed to osteopenia, and 16% of patients progressed to osteoporosis. A poster by the Aquitaine cohort being presented at this conference similarly shows rates of progression over 2.3 years of 7.8% of patients progressing to osteopenia and more than 11% of patients progressing to osteoporosis. So these very high prevalence rates coupled with strikingly high rates of progression really raise very valid concerns among physicians that we will be seeing an epidemic of fractures. And that leads me to the second question, are fractures more common in HIV-infected patients? This is less clear. There has been accumulating data presented over the last year, 18 months, that have examined fracture rates amongst various groups of people. One of the studies that I've chosen to highlight, which was published in JCEM in 2008 by a group in Boston, was a healthcare registry study which was able to examine data on more than 2 million people, more than 8,500 of which were HIV positive. And what this data demonstrated, the data shown in this graph represents the data from women, but the data in men is very similar. What this study demonstrates is, right across the age group range, that the prevalence of fractures in HIV-infected patients is higher than HIV negatives. Of particular concern within this study is the fact that if you look at the prevalence rates of fractures in HIV negatives, the prevalence really takes off when patients get into their 60s and 70s. While in the HIV positive population, you can see that the prevalence of fractures really starts to take off at a much earlier stage when people enter their 50s and 60s. Couple this with similar data in cardiovascular disease, similar data in cancers, really what you get is an impression that what we're seeing is that our HIV-infected patients are experiencing age-related morbidities at a much earlier age than one would expect from the general population. So how do we best go about measuring bone mineral density in our patients? Well, the DEXA scan provides us with bone mineral density data in two formats, the T-score and the Z-score. These two scores differ in the way that the data is represented in terms of the comparator group or the reference group that your data is presented against. So the T-score takes a patient's BMD and compares it to the bone mineral density of a young population with peak bone mass, while the Z-score takes a bone mineral density and presents it using a reference population of people from the same age, race, and gender. Now, without doubt, the T-score is the best predictor in terms of the clinical utility of DEXA scan to predict who's going to get fractures. Much of the data in the general population has used the T-score to derive fracture predictions. The problem with HIV, though, is that the data in the general population is predominantly drawn from postmenopausal women and from men over the age of 60. So using the T-score in our patient populations, which comprise younger men and a lot of premenopausal women, some would argue that the T-score is not the most appropriate measure and that we should use the Z-score. My personal feeling is that the contentious issue here really necessitates further research in large patient populations to determine which of these scores best predicts fracture rates within our younger patient population. So we move on to the relative contributions of antiretrovirals, bone mineral density, and vitamin D. To start off with antiretrovirals, the initial cross-sectional studies were quite confusing with a lot of conflicting results, but over the last 2 years, one consistent finding that's come through from clinical trials is that patients initiating antiretroviral treatment experience bone loss. This is a consistent finding that's been demonstrated in nearly every randomized controlled study that's looked at BMD over the past 2 years, and to date, there is not a single antiretroviral regime that has been tested in this setting that hasn't resulted in bone loss upon antiretroviral initiation. This raises the question, is this effect an antiviral effect, or is it a consequence of initiating treatment, i.e. suppressing the viral load and getting immune reconstitution? It's probably or most likely going to be both. But certainly, as more studies are presented, we do see that the changes in bone mineral density upon antiretroviral initiation will change considerably depending on which antiretroviral medication you start. This study from Peter Rice's group comparing cidovudin-based treatment to nucleoside-sparing-based treatment clearly shows the early loss that patients experience with antiretroviral initiation, which is much larger in patients who are on cidovudin-based treatment versus those on nucleoside-sparing treatment. Other studies have looked within the nucleoside class comparing abacavir-containing regimes and tenofovir-containing regimes. This is the ASSERT study that was presented at Cologne last year. And once again, we see all groups experiencing early bone loss, but what we see is greater bone loss in those exposed to tenofovir versus those exposed to abacavir-containing heart. Similarly, at Retrovirus Conference this year, the ACTG 5224 study results were presented. This was a four-arm study of antiretroviral-naive patients initiating either tenofovir or abacavir-containing regimens with an additional randomization to either efavirenz or boosted atazanavir. And once again, we see an early bone loss upon treatment initiation with significantly greater bone loss in those randomized to tenofovir-containing heart. If we move away from the NRTIs and start looking at differences between protease inhibitors and non-nukes, again, we see differences depending on which types of treatment patients initiate. In this French study of patients initiating either PI-based treatment or non-PI-based treatment, when you look at the lumbar spine, the first two columns are two different types of PI treatment. The third column is a PI-sparing regime. You can see that those initiating PI-based treatment experience greater bone loss than those not initiating PI-based treatment. But in contrast to the effect we see within the nucleoside class, the effect related to protease inhibitors seems to be especially prevalent in the cortical bone of the lumbar spine versus the trabecular bone at the hip. Again, these results were confirmed in the ACTG5224 study. When you look at the differences between efavirenz or atazanavir-based regimes, you see a much greater loss in bone mineral density in those randomized to efavirenz, but this difference is only occurring at the lumbar spine. So what about body mass index and bone mineral density? From the cross-sectional studies that have been presented, body mass index has consistently fallen out as being having a close association with low BMD and HIV. In fact, in one meta-analysis performed by colleagues in New Zealand, when they looked at HIV-positive groups and HIV-negative groups, even though they determined a difference in bone mineral density in those with HIV, much of this difference was actually explained by differences in body mass index. And it's clear also from the general population that as people get older, loss of weight is associated with a more rapid progression of bone mineral density or a more rapid loss of bone mineral density. But this weight loss in the elderly population is usually associated with negative health implications. So a more unhealthy person is more likely to lose more weight as they get older, therefore they lose more BMD. That type of association really hasn't been teased out in the HIV-positive setting, where low BMI, especially in young gay men, may not necessarily be associated with negative health. However, there are some prospective studies, and again, the French Aquitaine cohort, who are presenting their data this Wednesday, will also discuss the progression of BMD, showing that patients with lower BMI who are HIV positive actually have a faster loss of BMD over time. And lastly, there's the vitamin D story. We have a lot of posters. There's a specific session devoted to this on Wednesday, devoted to the problem of low vitamin D in HIV. And low vitamin D levels and vitamin D insufficiency and deficiency are very prevalent in HIV-infected populations. But when you look at the studies that have actually looked at HIV-positive patients and matched HIV-negative patients from the same socio-demographic areas, what we tend to see is the low vitamin D picture is really a picture that's spread throughout society. Whether or not there's specifically a greater effect of low vitamin D in HIV-infected patients in terms of bone health versus the general population really hasn't been teased out. There are associations between efavirenz exposure and low levels of the inactive 25-hydroxyvitamin D, and much has been made of this association. But the few studies that have actually looked at the active form of vitamin D, the 1,25-hydroxy, have failed to show this association. And certainly it would put the clinical relevance of this finding in some doubt. To go against vitamin D being a major player in terms of what's happening to our patients' bones, a nice study again by Peter Rice's group that's just recently been published, looking at 33 patients with primary HIV infection, so in the very early stages of HIV infection, again demonstrated very high prevalence rates of low bone mineral density, but none of the patients had a vitamin D level that was in the deficient or insufficient range. When we look at clinical studies where efavirenz is a component, we don't see a greater loss of bone mineral density in those initiating efavirenz versus those initiating other types of antiretrovirals. And when you look closer at what's going on underneath, the data would suggest that what's happening in our patients is that they are experiencing a high bone turnover state. Data from the ASSERT study, looking at markers of bone formation and bone resorption, show that upon initiation of antiretroviral treatment, all of these markers increase quite dramatically. Vitamin D is not associated with high bone turnover. You need to be vitamin D deficient for a very long time before you'll get clinically meaningful loss of bone mineral density. So all of these results really put vitamin D, in my view, in a much lower perspective, or the lower pecking order in terms of its potential to cause low BMD in our patients. So to finish up, who should be screened? Well, clearly everyone should be screened. It's how we screen and how we use our resources, I think, that are most important. There are, not everyone needs to have a DEXA scan. There are tools available that we can use at a clinic level that take patient demographics into account, tools such as the FRAC score, which is freely available online. And these tools can help us to predict which of our patients should be referred on for DEXA scanning. The European AIDS Clinical Society, in their recent guidelines on the prevention and management of comorbidity, have also suggested a list of risk factors that should prompt us to do a more formal assessment of bone health. And this should really be adopted in all of our patients while we wait for more data. And lastly, to finish off, when I thought about the double-edged sword, and then you look up about the double-edged sword, we're supposed to have favourable and unfavourable consequences, and everything that I've said up to now is probably quite negative. But there is an opportunity here. At the minute, we're really facing a patient population that is entering into that fifth decade of life. And now is the time that we should be introducing these testings, we should be introducing the screening, and we should be introducing treatment for these patients in order to maximize the reduction in fractures that our patients will experience over the next decade. I'd like to thank both the Irish and European funders that fund our ongoing research program. I'd also like to thank a very supportive family and thank you for your attention.
So thank you very much for an extremely clear and practical presentation. If there are questions from the floor? If not, may I ask you, Paddy, you know, is there any research of what we can do to avoid this initial drop in bone mineral density when we start any antiretroviral regimen?
So I know that there are studies ongoing that are looking at the use of bisphosphonates in the early parts of antiretroviral treatment to see if you can limit or eradicate that early bone loss. Certainly there are bisphosphonates on the market now that do have long half-lives, some that can be given as, you know, six-month or yearly doses. So there would be the potential, if this sort of strategy works, in patients, particularly vulnerable patients, to perhaps give them a single dose of a bisphosphonate and limit the loss of bone mineral density. The one issue around bisphosphonate use is we need to be clear what we want to do with bisphosphonates, and the reason to use bisphosphonates is to reduce fractures. And treating low BMD alone, even in that type of setting, may not correspond to a reduction in fractures. So I think we still need data in terms, particularly in younger people, in terms of whether or not bisphosphonate use is both safe and effective in reducing fractures as it would be in the older HIV-negative population.
Okay. I think Jules is in microphone six.
Yes. Hi, Paddy. Jules Levin. So I want to ask you to comment on anecdotal research of my own. I'm finding out that patients who are getting high-dose vitamin D supplementation from their doctors because they have low vitamin D, that it doesn't seem to really be working. They take the supplementation and levels may go up briefly and then they go right back down. And so I know you talked about your doubts about the association between vitamin D and fracture, but still it's disconcerting, and I don't think there's been any research to see if supplementation works in HIV as opposed to HIV negatives. Do you have any comments?
As usual, James, I think you're right on the button there. I think there has been a push amongst many clinicians to focus on vitamin D and focus on vitamin D replacement in terms of its, you know, perhaps it's an easy option to reverse what's going on in bone. The research hasn't been done. The research from the general population would suggest that vitamin D replacement in bone, although important, really isn't going to get you out of the woods in terms of reducing your fracture risk substantially. And again, to go back to this, the whole point of any intervention is to reduce fracture risk. So giving people vitamin D to make their vitamin D levels better is good because vitamin D has a lot of health benefits. But widespread use of vitamin D to try and solve the problem that we're seeing in HIV, I don't think the data is really there. And I think the focus needs to be on good quality research to answer the sorts of questions that you're raising.
Microphone three.
Yes, I'm curious whether the fractures are associated with impact or are they spontaneous or a combination of both?
So the limitation of the TRIAN study, although I think it's probably the best study to actually look at fracture rates, the limitation with it is that when you're dealing with health registry data, you can't really inform too much about what's causing the fractures. And certainly when you look at the potential things that will cause fractures in our patients, we've got to look at things like fragility. We've got to look at things like drug use and a greater potential for falls. And then we've got to look at BMD. So I think the TRIAN data informs us that there is a clinical problem. What it doesn't do is inform us as to what's driving that problem. But I think if we start to put a lot of the studies together, a lot of this other ancillary data, we get an idea of the main issues within our patient population that need to be addressed if we're going to reduce the fracture rates. But again, it's a contentious area and an area that's definitely worthy of further study.
So let me thank you again for your presentation. Now it's my pleasure to welcome to the podium to Dr. George Behrens. Dr. Behrens is an assistant professor of T-cell immunology at Hanover Medical School in Germany. After he was in the Division of Clinical Immunology at Hanover Medical School, he went as a postdoctoral fellow to the Immunology Division at the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute in Melbourne, Australia. He's an internationally acknowledged expert in metabolic side effects of HIV therapy. So he's going to talk about heart HIV and cardiovascular disease. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, and also thank you to the organizers for inviting me to this conference and give this overview. I've split my talk into four different parts, and I would like to start with some data about the epidemiology on this issue. If we look into different cohort studies, mostly retrospective or also prospective HIV cohort studies or administrative databases, and compare the number of events for cardiovascular disease with seronegative people, then we do see a continuous trend that there is an increase of the incidence rate of cardiovascular events in HIV-infected patients across different cohorts. If we take this to another level and look for surrogate markers of cardiovascular disease, not only events, again, we do see in HIV-infected patients something very similar as compared to HIV-negative individuals. As an example, for instance, age is an important factor. As you see, per year increase, we do see an increased rate of cardiovascular events of about 6 to 9%, which is very similar to what we see in HIV non-infected individuals. And that holds also true for other factors like diabetes mellitus or smoking, for instance, where we know this is an important risk factor, as we do see in seronegative people. And also HDL as a more beneficial factor. With every increase of this unit, we do see a decrease in HIV or non-HIV-related cardiovascular events, meaning a very similar pattern. That's all well and good, but what does it really mean to others, more serious events? If we look again in different cohorts like the DAD or another multinational multi-cohort analysis, we do see that cardiovascular disease-related events are responsible for about 10% of all causes of death in the cohorts. That's still far below other reasons for liver-related death or AIDS-related death. So why is it important now to look at this and have some thoughts about it? I think it's for several reasons, and I want to illustrate this in the next slides. First, it's traditional risk factors that we find very often in HIV-infected patients. Smoking, obesity, hypertension, and dyslipidemia is very prevalent in treated HIV patients. And also the risk for type 2 diabetes, for instance, is 4 to 5 times higher in HIV-infected patients as compared to others. And these risk factors also determine cardiovascular events, as again being shown by the DAD study. We do see being male, having previous cardiovascular disease, being a smoker or having diabetes really increases the risk for cardiovascular disease. And we do see on the very top also another factor, that's aging, also an important contributor to cardiovascular disease. And Patty already have shown some data on the aging population in HIV. I want to illustrate it in a slightly different way. I took this from a review about the estimate development of the total world population, as you can see, and also the percentage of the population older than 60 over the next couple of years. If I now, with a just rough estimate, calculate this for the German HIV population, for instance, you do see that the slope of this curve will be dramatically different, because all the mid-40s infected, HIV-infected people will, within the next 15 years, turn 60 and older. And that's why this factor becomes more important. That leads us to HIV therapy and its role. Let's assume this is the lipid profile of any given HIV patient who's or not yet infected person with cholesterol, triglycerides, and HDL. What we in general assume is that HIV infection, at least in an advanced stage, if these values are rather normal, would lead to a slight decrease in cholesterol, a slight increase in triglycerides, and usually HIV-infected patients have a low HDL. Most HIV therapies will lead to a modest increase in cholesterol, to some increase in triglycerides, and have only little impact on HDL. And having said that, we all know that this is oversimplified, because we know that certain drugs, for instance, like NNRTIs, have a more beneficial effect on HDL, that PIs differ in their effects on triglycerides, and that more recently developed drugs like integrase inhibitors and CCL5 inhibitors also have less effects at all. But anyway, overall, over the last years, it has become clear that factors in glucose metabolism, in dyslipidemia, and also associated factors with apodystrophy, mainly central obesity, induced by HIV therapy, contribute to HIV-related cardiovascular disease. This all becomes more complicated because all these factors are interrelated. And of course, there are other factors like age, genetics, diet, and other underlying mechanisms that contribute to this. Over the last years, it has also become clear that some specific drugs might directly interfere with the occurrence of cardiovascular disease. You all know many of these data, again, initially showed by the DAD study. Among the PIs that had been looked at so far, not all of them have been studied. Indinavir and lopinavir stick out a bit with increased risk for myocardial infarction. There's no such signal in NNRTIs, but again in the NRTIs, at least in this study for DDI and abacavir, there was an increased risk for cumulative and also recent use for abacavir. That of course prompted a lot of other researchers to look in their databases, and I've summarized many of these studies. You see that many of them are very different in their design, and for most, and very important, they're very different in the number of events that they can capture. Taken together, more often than not, most of these studies could confirm this signal and this association of abacavir use and myocardial infarction, although not all, clearly. That raised the question what could be the mechanism, and it was, I think, the SMART study, the first one to suggest that patients with abacavir treatment, if when they compared to non-abacavir treated patients, signs for systemic inflammation were increased, in that CRP levels and IL-6 levels were significantly different. More research is still ongoing on this. For instance, some researchers would suggest that abacavir from in vitro studies might activate leukocytes to upregulate MEK1, which then interacts with ICAM, for instance, on endothelial cells. Other researchers would favor that abacavir could interfere with the platelet function in HIV-infected patients, leading to increased clotting risk. But looking more into clinical data, again, at least four different studies did not find any association of abacavir use with systemic markers of inflammation, as I've listed them here. So there's still no real verdict. It's still unclear what the mechanism could be. That's why I put a little question mark behind this inflammation pathway. But with that, we come to the next point, because we have another candidate that could act through this inflammatory pathway, and that's HIV. Again, the SMART study was the first to show that patients that interrupted HIV therapy in this early phase had a higher risk for non-AIDS-defining events, and namely cardiovascular disease again, as compared to those patients that continued therapy. It's very hard to dissect the role of HIV in these conditions, so we really have to rely on surrogate markers and other settings. Again, this study, also looking at treatment interruptions, could confirm that when patients went off therapy, as the viral load went up, their activation of T cells went also up, and also soluble surrogate markers for inflammation. And the authors then concluded, like with a double-edged sword, lipids went down if you go off treatment, it's not shown in this slide, but immune activation went up. And what's the net benefit then for the patient? Other surrogate studies, like the FRAM study, was recently presented, again looking for surrogate markers for intermedia thickness as an equivalent to atherosclerosis. And they identified the known risk factors, as we've seen in previous studies. But they also showed that HIV infection itself, even if treated, had an independent contribution to this surrogate marker, suggesting that HIV directly does something in these patients. Indeed, there's a whole bunch of further evidence. We know that HIV can induce apoptosis and interfere with endothelial cells, that HIV can interfere with leukocyte activation and systemic markers of inflammation that we can measure, that HIV can interfere with chemokine axes and loops that are very important also in atherogenesis, and that genetic risk factors are also important in these circumstances. Some researchers even think, although I think there's limited evidence for that, that this is a distinct inflammatory process going on. Coming to other co-infections, more viruses coming in, it's getting even worse in terms of surrogate markers in HCV co-infected people, also with increased risk for myocardial infarction. We know that at least in some, not in all studies, low CD4 cell counts can be a risk factor, and that HIV therapy partially improves endothelial function but cannot restore it to normal. And then still HIV is an independent predictor of atherosclerosis and can also interfere with monocytes. So that's HIV directly, but also we have to consider a new understanding of the pathogenesis of HIV. If this is the gut mucosa layer with immune cells underneath, what we've learned is that in the early phase of the infection, HIV infects the CD4 cells, also very important Th17 cells and other cells, and this leads to a mucosal barrier disruption so that microbial products can translocate, like lipopolysaccharides, into the circulation, which then in turn activate macrophages, which release then other factors which contribute to immune activation and disruption of other problems. And atherosclerosis is not only a lipid-driven but also an inflammatory-driven disease. As we can see, LDL, for instance, is recruited, gets oxidized, then activates endothelial cells, which then recruit T cells and monocytes, and this is the first formation of an atherosclerotic lesion. And these monocytes then turn into macrophages, which then, by a scavenger receptor, capture further lipids, transform into foam cells, and also become activated to further support inflammation, coagulation, and apoptosis. If we put all these together, we see that atheroformation, plaque instability, and hypercoagulability are all supported by an underlying inflammation. We know that the traditional factors mainly support atheroma formation and growth, and that HIV therapy, through these mechanisms, can also facilitate this. Remembering the data about abacavir, we now have to assume that at least some certain drugs might also, through inflammation or specifically interfering with these pathways, contribute to this. And then a third player comes into the picture, which is HIV, then through inflammation or direct interaction also with platelets, for instance, could facilitate atherosclerosis and the respective events. With that, I come to the last point, quickly to summarize what could that mean in clinical care. I tried to illustrate it on this figure. Let's assume we've got a patient who's got a viral load and needs treatment. With the HIV therapy, we decrease the viral load below limit of detection. With that, we also presumably improve the inflammation that's associated with HIV, and this anyway low myocardial risk goes down further. But now we've got some patients which might develop some side effects under the treatments that we use, like type 2 diabetes, disturbed lipids. Thereby, the net effect might be gone, so that there is a slight increase. In most patients, it wouldn't really matter because the modest underlying risk is very low. But let's consider some patients with an already underlying high risk because they have disturbed lipids or obesity. In those patients, it's particularly important to consider these factors and to choose the right therapy, not to do harm. I selected, just as a suggestion, the European guidelines how to deal with these issues because they have been updated last year. It's something they recommend would be to assess the cardiovascular disease risk for the next 10 years using scores like the Framingham score, for instance, advise all patients on diet and lifestyle modifications, and consider, especially in patients with a very high risk, to change therapy if that's possible and options are still available. And then you continue to identify all key modifiable risk factors, including smoking, blood pressure, and the others that I've listed. And then if there's cut levels above the threshold, then to decide really also to use drug treatment. And then also to consider certain drug targets. I don't want to end with one remark, that HIV in the heart is not only about myocardial infarction, because this is an international AIDS conference. There is also evidence for other problems, of course. Diastolic dysfunction is very prevalent. QT prolongation has a high prevalence in HIV and is associated with several drugs. And of course, many of the infectious complications can also occur in these patients. Thank you very much.
Thank you, George, for a great presentation. We can take questions from the floor now. So, George, when we have an HIV-infected patient and we achieve suppression and the patient is below 50, there is still persistent inflammation and immune activation. What is the research going about? What can we do about that in those patients?
Yeah, that's a very good point. Ongoing viral replication, of course, leads to inflammation, but there's still some low-level replication or inflammation apparently going on, even in successfully treated patients, as we can see if we compare these to uninfected controls. It's very difficult to find specific interventions in that, because you don't want to have an unspecific immunosuppression in that situation. I think there is some research now going on to look how HIV, for instance, interferes with platelets, with endothelials, in order to find potential targets. But I think for the next couple of years, we will rely on identifying patients with a high risk and try to treat them against HIV as good as possible.
So if there are no more questions, let me thank you again for your presentation.
Thank you.
All right, it's my pleasure to introduce my colleague, Dr. Mohammed Atta. Dr. Atta is an associate professor of medicine in the Division of Nephrology at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and medical director of the DaVita Dialysis Unit in East Baltimore. He's going to talk to us about kidney conundrums, HIV, and renal disease.
Thanks, Joel. Good afternoon. I would like to thank the organizer for inviting me for this conference. Generally, my name actually gets a lot of recognition, usually in airport securities, but I feel honored to be invited here. My talk is going to be twofold. One is to review the implications of kidney disease in HIV-infected individuals, and the second part is to discuss the pros and cons of deferred versus early heart in this population from the renal standpoint. I'm going to start with a non-HIV population, and this is really one of my favorite studies, the heart outcome study, which included 9,000 patients. It was a randomized trial to look at the efficacy of Remibrill or vitamin E on the primary outcome or cardiovascular mortality. When the investigators actually started looking at the best predictor of cardiovascular outcome, it was microalbuminuria. So microalbuminuria actually was the best predictor, better than actually history of coronary artery disease, diabetes, serum creatinine above 1.4, being a man or age, or, and obviously ramipril was protective in the study. A more powerful analysis just came out in The Lancet in May that included more than 1 million individuals, non-HIV again, and then the investigator, Joe Koresh and colleagues, looked at the interaction between GFR and proteinuria. They found 14 studies that actually looked at ASR plus GFR. So the upper panel is basically looking at ASR and GFR. As GFR goes down below 60, you can see that there is definite increase in the hazard ratio for all-cause mortality. Now, they had seven studies that included only dipstick. So looking by dipstick reaction, again, you can see as GFR goes down, mortality goes up, and you can see on the right panel here that the mortality is mostly driven by cardiovascular mortality. What was interesting about this study that even trace proteinuria by dipstick was associated with increased mortality. Can we apply this to the HIV population? Elizabeth George, from a medical student from India, looked at a nested matched case control study from the Hopkins cohort. She identified 63 cases who had cardiovascular events, and she had matched those with 315 HIV-infected individuals without cardiovascular events, and looked at eGFR identified by CKD EBI formula and the MDRD equation. In the unadjusted analysis, GFR, or estimated GFR less than 60, was associated with 16-fold increase in cardiovascular events. Adjusted odds ratio showed that a decline in GFR by 10 ml was associated with 20% increase in cardiovascular events. The prevalence of proteinuria in cases was 51% versus 25% in control, and proteinuria in the adjusted analysis again was associated with twofold increase in the cardiovascular events. This is a Lewis smoother curve. It's a regression analysis looking at events here on the y-axis versus no events. These are the control cases, the 300 plus cases, and these are here on the top are the event cases. And you can see that the event cases, their GFR was spread all out, the x-axis. If you look at the cases, all the patients had their GFR around 120. So the mean estimated GFR was 68 in the cases versus 103 in the control. The VA study is a cohort study by Andy Choi, looked at the same event rate in patients with HIV-infected infection, 1,194 patients with estimated GFR less than 60, and the outcome was, again, incident cardiovascular disease or incident heart failure. They looked also at urine albumin by dipstick, and again, as the GFR goes down, you have increase in the risk or the hazards for cardiovascular events or heart failure as well. Again, if you look at proteinuria, from no proteinuria, 30 milligram per deciliter or more than 100 milligram per deciliter, you can see a stepwise increase in the cardiovascular event rate and also in the heart failure. Christina Weiss from Mount Sinai in New York looked at the Weiss cohort, which are HIV-infected women, 1,500 women, and again, looking at survival by albumin dipstick. So those who had no proteinuria or albuminuria had much better survival compared to those with unconfirmed or confirmed microalbuminuria, meaning that they had one dipstick that was positive, that was unconfirmed. Confirmed means two dipstick that were positive for albumin versus those with confirmed proteinuria had the worst survival. So again, albuminuria in the non-HIV population and in the HIV population was associated with increased cardiovascular event rate and mortality. So the second part is, what about deferred treatment versus early treatment? In my mind, as a nephrocentric person, the deferred treatment carries the risk of HIVN, HIV-associated nephropathy. The early treatment is associated with heart toxicity and metabolic derangement. HIVN, we did learn from the animal study, the direct role of HIV in the development of HIV-associated nephropathy through the products of accessory genes like the NIF and the VBR. The disease is very aggressive. If you look at the normal glomerulus, every one of us should have a million of those. So you have the glomerulus encompassed by the Bowman's capsule, and then in green here is the basement membrane that separates the glomerulus into two compartments, the inner compartment that has the blood and the mesangium, and the outer compartment that has the podocytes and the urine space. Here, by light microscopy of a normal glomerulus, if you look at HIVN patients, they have complete collapse of the capillary tuft, and if you look at the tubules, they have microcystic dilatation. So the tubule actually increases in size by threefold. None of the clinical features are diagnostic, so biopsy is usually needed for the diagnosis. We know it's an aggressive disease. It is associated with heavy proteinuria. Those patients have detectable viremia and detectable viral proviral DNA. They have normal-sized kidney because the kidney does not have time to shrink, so they have normal-sized kidneys, and it progresses to renal failure within weeks to months. One unique feature about the disease is that it is exclusive of Africans or black patients. We didn't know why until Jeffrey Cobb came in 2008 and did a genome-wide analysis and found a peak around chromosome 22 that looked promising as to be the site for association with HIV-associated nephropathy. He compared black individuals with HIVN and other kidney disease to black individuals without HIVN and also with Caucasians. And if you look at the chromosome 22, there was a lot of genes, and the focus initially was on the MYH9. It's non-muscle myosin H9. And the reason they focus on this gene, actually, because it is located or localized in the podocyte, in the kidney. And fair enough, they found that actually variability in this gene was associated with fivefold increase in the incidence of HIVN. So if you have two risk allele of this variant, you have fivefold risk for developing HIVN. Everybody was excited by the MYH9 SNPs until a group recently just published in Science a new finding. They focused on the apolipoprotein 1. And the apolipoprotein 1 gene is a survival gene. It actually protects against the infection of trypanosoma in Africa. And they found that if you have variation in this gene, you actually have a tenfold increase to develop kidney disease and end-stage renal disease. This just came out 3 days ago. In any way, we know that HIVN can be prevented and treated with heart. So this is by my colleague, Greg Lucas. He looked at a cohort, a 12-year cohort in Hopkins, and stratified the patients by having no AIDS versus those with AIDS. On the y-axis, cases per 1,000 per year, person per year. If you have no AIDS, the incidence of HIVN was zero. If you have AIDS and you are not on heart, the incidence was 26.3 per 1,000 person per year, so about 3%. We showed, in collaboration with the chairman, Dr. Gallant, that patients who were treated with antiretroviral therapy have a better renal survival versus those who were not treated with heart. That's why now the guidelines recommend that HIVN is an indication to start heart regardless of the HIV status. Now, what about the risk of early heart from the renal perspective? Again, you know that heart is associated with increase in the incidence of diabetes. This is a study from the MAX, or the multicenter AIDS cohort, who's having sex with men. Those patients who were treated with heart have a fourfold increase in the development of diabetes, and those especially who were treated with protease inhibitors had threefold increase in the risk of diabetes. From the same cohort, those patients who were exposed to HART were associated with increased incidence of systolic hypertension, not too much diastolic hypertension. What about specific renal disorders related to heart therapy? We all know about indenavir and its association with these crystals. Atazanavir is another drug that is associated with crystals. The incidence with atazanavir, according to the French cohort, is about 1%. What is unique about these crystals in both indenavir and atazanavir that they form actually in alkaline urine. So patients who are vegetarian, for instance, tend to have alkaline urine and they are at higher risk to develop these crystals. Tenofovir has been associated with acute renal failure, Fanconi syndrome, nephrogenic diabetes insipidus, and probably chronic kidney disease. And the mechanism by which tenofovir actually can cause kidney disease is not fully understood. We know that the proximal tubular cells of the kidney is the target for a lot of toxicity. If you look at the proximal tubular cells, this is the lumen, this is the interstitium of the blood, the apical membrane, that's where the urine, and a lot of drugs are filtered, but a lot of drugs are also secreted from the blood through the urine. The practical example for this was really during World War II, when penicillin was discovered, and it was in short supply, and they tried to treat the troops with penicillin. It wasn't until 1951 when probenecid was discovered and was found to actually delay the secretion of penicillin from the blood to the urine. Also, another story about probenecid in 1988, the Tour de France, the winner was a Spanish guy who actually used probenecid because he was using anabolic steroids and was able to win the crown despite the fact he was using anabolic steroid to prevent the secretion of steroid anabolic drugs in the urine. Tenofovir, you can protect the kidney actually by giving probenecid because you prevent actually the secretion of tenofovir into the proximal tubular cells. All NRTIs are secreted through these transporters. The organic anion transporters goes inside the cell and then it gets out in the urine through another transporter, the multi-drug resistant transporters. So the idea is that if you actually overdose someone with a drug, you can actually overwhelm these transporters and you can increase the availability of these drugs inside the proximal tubular cells and you can cause mitochondrial toxicity. If you give any drug that actually compete with the secretions of these drugs in the urine, again, you can accumulate these drugs in the proximal tubular cells and develop toxicity. This is a recent publication that came from Europe, the Eurocyta study that showed that in 6,000 plus patients, the incidence of chronic kidney disease was 3.3 over a median follow-up of 3.7, and there was association between CKD and tenofovir, indenavir, atazanavir, and lopinavir or Kaletra, and the CKD incidence was between 8% and 21% using these drugs. The aging is another problem. This is a study from Hopkins, 1,000 patients looking at the difference effect of tenofovir on patients with above 45 versus those less than 30 versus those between age 30 and 45. And again, you see that those patients with age above 45, they had a much worse decline in the renal function. Usually at day 300 is the most effect. These are my suggested recommendations. There is no evidence of benefit from the renal standpoint for early HIV treatment, except for HIVAN, and this is a late manifestation of HIV. In treated or untreated patients, I think we should screen all patients with GFR, urine albumin, and urine protein, and for high-risk patients, monitor kidney disease on a regular basis. And for those with non-Hyvan kidney disease, new studies are needed to determine benefits. Thank you.
Thank you, Mohammed, for that excellent presentation. I wanted to ask you, if you look at some large studies, and I was thinking specifically of the DART study in Africa, where tenofovir was a component, and yet when you put people on antiretroviral therapy, their kidney function tended to improve. Do you think that's entirely explainable by a reduction in Hyvan, or is there any other possible mechanism of benefit that could explain that kind of a finding?
Well, it's definitely important to realize that patients who are not treated with heart and they have progressive HIV disease, they will develop kidney disease. But I'm not sure, we don't have any studies from Africa about Hyvan, and it's very premature to say that this is really a reduction in Hyvan, and I will have to wait.
It's from the floor.
Well, since there aren't any, let me ask you another question. we typically hear that tenofovir nephrotoxicity is a proximal tubular toxicity of phosphate wasting, and yet that seems like, maybe we're not looking close enough, but it seems like that's a subset of the overall declines in GFR that we sometimes see. Can you just clarify, is there a real distinction between glomerular toxicity and tubular toxicity, or are they ultimately all going to be the same entity?
Well, my view is that really tenofovir is a proximal tubular toxin, not a glomerular toxin. But if you give the drug to someone who has underlying kidney disease, you actually put them at risk to develop also progressive glomerular disease. So if you separate two patients, one with a normal GFR and one with normal GFR, the one with low GFR, the one with normal GFR is at risk to develop proximal toxicity. Those with low GFR, they really, you have to be careful of using the drug because of the potential for glomerular toxicity as well. One other aspect, which was shown in the Swiss cohort, it was in Croy last year, that those on tenofovir, they have a lot of phosphate wasting. Now, you may ask, what is the clinical implications of phosphate wasting? I think it has been presented before that if we are talking about bone disease, we have to actually think about osteomalacia from phosphate wasting as well.
Jules, microphone 6.
Can you hear me? Can you clarify?
Yes.
I think the guidelines, the U.S. guidelines, recommends early therapy for patients with Hyvan, but didn't you say that early therapy does not benefit patients with Hyvan? Is that correct?
No, I said that, yes, the U.S. guidelines recommend starting the patients on Hyvan regardless of their HIV status. However, Hyvan is a late manifestation of HIV disease. It is uncommon to see actually a patient with CD4 count, for instance, of 500 or above developing Hyvan. You have to have very high viral load. You have to have very low CD4 count to actually develop Hyvan. Not to say that there are cases that has been reported actually in the literature with early Hyvan, but these are the rarity, not the usual cases.
But yet you said that heart does not benefit Hyvan, right?
No, I did not say
you
that.
You didn't say that, okay.
No. Hyvan actually is treated by heart. So if you actually have a patient who is diagnosed with Hyvan and you give them antiretroviral therapy, they have a much better renal survival compared to those who are not treated.
Microphone 3.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you, doctor, for that presentation. My name is Matthew Dasho. I'm a clinician with the Botswana UPenn partnership in Gaborone, Botswana. And I appreciate you presenting this topic because we are seeing a lot of renal disease in sub-Saharan Africa. And what I'd like to ask you is, what are your thoughts on how, in a relatively resource-limited setting, how we can proceed with screening for HIV-associated nephropathies? The only data that I'm familiar with in sub-Saharan Africa are small studies where it's been shown that the spectrum of renal disease in sub-Saharan Africa associated with HIV is far more than just HIVAN. It's also immune complex disease, it's post-infectious glomerulonephritis. And so in a resource-limited setting where you can't biopsy everybody, we're relying on your analysis. And so, and with a huge prevalence also of hypertensive kidney disease and increasing cardiovascular events, I wanted to see what your thoughts were on, in a resource-limited setting, how we can proceed and how to manage what is becoming a huge problem.
Yeah, this is really a very good question. And again, I'm going to focus on how to actually monitor patients. And to monitor patients, we need to use the tools that we have. And I think everyone can get serum creatinine, everyone can get a urine dipstick or urine albumin to creatinine ratio. If we can actually do that, we can monitor kidney disease very well in a resource-limited setting. I mean, we are not going to look at inflammatory markers like IL-6 and CRB and all these, and even viral load is not measured on a regular basis in these areas. So I think urine dipstick, if we can monitor those patients every 3 months or every 6 months even by dipstick and serum creatinine, that would be actually the best you can do.
Okay, one last very quick question and answer, microphone 9.
Doug Fish, Albany, New York. Even in resource available areas, can you comment on the role of renal biopsy in the workup of HIVAN, and is it necessary or not?
Well, again, giving my nephrocentric views, I think HIVAN, the only way you can actually diagnose is with kidney biopsy. The reason I'm saying this is because there is a lot of disorders that actually can mimic HIVAN in terms of nephrotic range proteinuria and aggressive progression of kidney disease. A lot of these patients have hepatitis C co-infection, so you have actually membranoproliferative GN, and you have immune complex or lupus-like GN in this population. So to rely on the just clinical markers, it may not actually be the best way to do it. The way I can actually look at it in a different way, how to exclude HIVAN. So to exclude HIVAN, if you have a patient with no proteinuria or minimal proteinuria, if they have high CD4 count, if they have low viral load, those patients are unlikely to have HIVAN. So excluding HIVAN is much easier than confirming HIVAN with these resources.
All right, thank you very much again for that wonderful talk. Our next and final speaker is Dr. Victor Valcour, who is an internist and geriatrician at the Memory and Aging Center at UCSF, San Francisco, California, where he's an associate professor of geriatric medicine and neurology. He's completed fellowships in both geriatric medicine and neurobehavior, and his primary research interest is in brain health in aging HIV-infected patients.
Great. Thank you very much for the introduction. Also, thank you to the conference committee for inviting me to speak. Over the past couple years, I've enjoyed the ability to finally come out of the closet as a geriatrician in this audience. When I began this work 10 years ago, there was not a lot of thought about aging and HIV. When we started our first cohort of aged HIV patients who were over 50 in Honolulu back in 2001, it was not a great interest in people, but now there's a lot of interest. So I'll add some of the information regarding some of our aging work into the talk today. I thought a little bit about the title as well. I didn't choose this title. It was chosen for me, Out of Sight and Out of Mind. And as I thought about it carefully, I thought about how appropriate it is. Because even to this day, cognitive impairment in the setting of HIV is a silent epidemic. It really, in clinics, it's out of sight and it's out of mind. And I want to point out to you today, perhaps the most important point I can bring home is that it's quite frequent and needs more work. So I'll start off by telling you the main points I thought I'd talk about today. First of all, that cognitive impairment is frequent. I will not be able to go through all the mechanisms by which we think cognitive impairment may be continuing to be an active problem. But I wanted to point out just two examples. One, from my research, which will point to you that there probably is an active disease underlying some of the impairment. It's likely immunologically based. My bias is that it's probably monocyte based, but chronic immune activation T cells may be contributing as well. I have another example where I would like to bring out the very important aspect of confounding factors with regard to brain health. I won't be able to go through all of these in detail, but I'll give you one example and leave you to think about that a little bit more. I thought I'd close the talk by speaking a little bit about aging in HIV and the concerns that have been raised, and perhaps some cautiously good news regarding this. So first, I'll start off by presenting some data from 2008 that was published by Kevin Robertson and others using data from the ACTG. He identified that patients who were changing therapy or starting therapy, about 39% of them tested in an impaired range when they began treatment. Unfortunately, after these patients were on treatment for 48 weeks, of the people who were healthy, a good quarter, 20%, developed impairment over that period of time. And these data are probably quite consistent with what we're finding in many other studies, perhaps the largest one funded by the NIMH, called the Charter Study, is just starting to point out some of the data. This is an important slide that I borrowed from Igor Grant, and I'll talk you through it carefully. He had three cohorts that he had studied in San Diego, and then the most recent cohort, of course, the Charter, which is five centers, over 1,000 patients. And he compared rates of impairment on cognitive testing during the cohort that was enrolled in the pre-HART era, the pre-antiretroviral era, and the HART era. And what he found here, and you can perhaps concentrate on CDC stage A disease, there really is not a lot of change in the rate of impairment despite the use of HART. Across the other stages, you can see as well, there has not been a lot of improvement. Some people ask me if you give cognitive tests to a large enough population of people, some people are going to be impaired. And in fact, you can see here on the left that that's true. If you test HIV negative people, presumably reasonably healthy, some of them will test in an impaired range. But you can see that the rate of impairment in patients with HIV is much, much higher. And you can consider that perhaps some of the background. The good news about all of this is that HIV-associated dementia, the worst kind of cognitive impairment, is now quite rare. It probably constitutes only 1 or 2% of the population, as depicted in this slide. There are two other kinds of impairment diagnostically that constitute the large amount of impairment that occurs: HIV mild neurocognitive disorder and HIV asymptomatic neurocognitive impairment. And together, about half of patients who have HIV will have abnormal testing and fall into one of these areas. So the flip side to that is about 50% of people will test perfectly fine on neurocognitive tests. That may speak a little bit to why it's somewhat of a silent epidemic. The asymptomatic portion, I have to point out as well, is quite concerning. Many people would never call a disease if it's asymptomatic. The challenge is that there's so much stigma attached to HIV, and the populations who have HIV, that many times we don't have good objective information. And if you're asking a patient who has cognitive impairment to have insight into how much impairment they have, I think you have to consider some of that suspect. And we're beginning to capture some information about that, because in the study we're running now in San Francisco, we insist on having proxy information, and we'll perhaps get more clarity on that. But it is a little bit unusual in a disease of dementia to have somebody come into a clinic and be alone. All of my Alzheimer's patients come in with somebody, a caregiver, a loved one, who assists them, but it's not uncommon for me to see HIV patients who come in alone, making it somewhat difficult. I also want to remind you that the symptoms of cognitive impairment are not just my memory's bad. In fact, it's been known for many years, based on where the virus gets into the brain, that there probably is a triad of symptoms that constitute the neurobehavioral syndrome of cognitive impairment. And if we focus only on cognition, looking at memory loss, concentration, mental slowing, we actually miss a lot of what probably is HIV-related brain injury, including symptoms that relate more to behavior and to motor. I also want to point out that under the cognition, I'm not mentioning memory as the sole entity. And in fact, many of the patients that I see who have cognitive impairment will tell me their symptoms are more complex than that. That if they develop good compensatory measures, they can get through things, but if you give them two or three tasks to do at the same time, they begin to have some challenges. And these compensatory measures, as well as, I think, the energy of some people with HIV, allows them to stay in employment many times, even though they may take 10 hours to do an 8-hour job, or they may use a lot more compensatory measures to get through the day. So I think these are important aspects to remember with regard to the syndrome. I also want to point out that from the San Diego group, that even patients who have mild impairment do not function well when you give them tasks in a research setting and ask them to accomplish them. For example, if you ask somebody to do balancing of a checkbook, writing checks, doing medication compliance work, reading prescriptions in a manner that would allow them to be adherent, even these more simple tasks, there's a higher rate of impairment as depicted by this slide. And just to bring this point home a little bit more with regard to the silent epidemic, I'll tell you a very interesting case of a patient I saw recently in my research study. He was 79 years of age. I'm recruiting people who are over 60 living with HIV as a chronic illness. So one of my colleagues said, this is a great patient for you. He would be a great control. He has no cognitive symptoms. And when I interviewed the patient, he agreed that he was generally asymptomatic. He told me that he liked opera and he used to be able to remember all the names of the singers, and a lot of it escapes him now, but really minimized any symptoms. He's likely been infected since the mid-1980s, and fortunately for him, had very few comorbid medical illnesses. He was asymptomatic for a long time, started heart when his CD4 cell count dropped below 200, about 2001. Never had opportunistic infections, has some neuropathy. His viral load is well controlled. It's been well controlled for a decade. CD4 cell count never had a great rise, but it hasn't been below 200 over the past decade. As I mentioned to you, really not a lot of medical problems. Hepatitis A. One challenge is he has intermittent drug use, and I would caution anyone who sees older people not to assume that they don't use drugs over a certain age. He had used methamphetamine the last time when he was 75 years old. His neurologic exam was clearly abnormal. He had increased reflexes, his finger tapping was slow, his eye movements were abnormal, and on neuropsychological testing, he was abnormal across the board, on almost every test, tests well below. And just a picture can paint a much better image for you. This is an image of his MRI. For those of you who are not familiar with reading these, the black area in the middle is the CSF, and it should not be so large. It's likely large because of brain atrophy, shrinkage of the brain, and the areas around it that have white matter are also abnormal. So this is clearly an abnormal brain, an abnormal neuropsychological testing profile, and an abnormal neurologic examination in a patient who's presumed to be asymptomatic. So let's move on. Why is this happening? I'm going to try to point out two things, just to bring home two points to you. One point is that I think that this is an active disease. I think if we begin to think that this is burnt out disease of before patients were on heart, if we begin to think that these are all due to confounding factors, I think we're missing the boat. In my research, I think there's an active disease and we're inadequately treating it with the existing regimens that we have. I also want to point out to you that confounding factors, coexisting morbidity, probably are going to be quite important in terms of cognitive impairment, and in fact can be an addressable approach. So this is my big scientific slide. I apologize to people if this becomes too complex, but I think in order to understand the brain in the HIV environment, I have to point some of this out. The blood-brain barrier is depicted here in the top. The cells on the top are lymphocytes, monocytes particularly in this diagram. The brain is inside the blood-brain barrier, so in the lower part of the screen. And in fact, when people are infected with HIV, the HIV gets into the bloodstream very quickly. We've now enrolled, I think, 20 patients who have been infected with HIV for less than 3 weeks, patients who are in FEBIG stage 2 and 3 in Bangkok. And we're beginning to see that, in fact, in these cases, brain injury in some cases is present as early as the first month, and virus is entering at least the CSF in some of those cases. So we know it likely gets into the brain quite early in infection. And it's believed that these monocytes become infected and cross the blood-brain barrier. This has been called the Trojan horse effect where the virus enters the brain through the cells, the monocytes. Once they get into the cells, into the brain, they actually don't infect brain cells very much, but they cause a lot of dysfunction, particularly neurons. There's not a lot of neuronal infection, but there's damage to the neurons. The arborization, the trees of the nerves become cut back. The synaptic connections are not so good. These have been shown in nice work done by Eliezer Maslia. And in fact, this probably has a rebound effect affecting the blood-brain barrier, allowing more virus or cells to get through the bloodstream. Given this model, what happens when you give somebody antiretroviral's heart? Well, you can clearly get rid of the virus in the bloodstream. We can't detect it in the bloodstream. But we're really not measuring it in the cells that are in the bloodstream. And in fact, in many cases, it remains in the cells of the bloodstream. Moreover, we're not measuring it in the brain. We're not measuring it in the brain cells. And so there are several reservoirs, several important areas where virus remains. And we think that this may be particularly important for the brain. And I'll tell you why. We did a small study in Bangkok. We looked at people with and without dementia. We measured the amount of HIV DNA that was in their circulating monocytes. And you can see on the right side of the screen, every case with dementia had a higher HIV DNA level. It almost completely separated our dementia and our non-dementia cases. What I think is more intriguing is that when we treated these patients with antiretroviral therapy in the middle slide at 6 months, in the far right slide at 12 months, all of them had undetectable plasma viral loads. But you can see that the cases that were enrolled with dementia were never able to clear, or many of them were not able to clear the reservoir of DNA in their monocytes. We think this may be an active phenomenon. In work we did in Honolulu, we also looked at this HIV DNA in people who've been on antiretrovirals for 4, 5, or 6 years. On the right side, patients with undetectable viral load, you can see that patients who are impaired are more likely to have HIV DNA in this circulating monocyte reservoir. Based on information from SIV-infected macaques, we think these cells are coming from the bone marrow. They're probably infected when they leave the bone marrow. They don't remain in the bloodstream for a very long time. Staining of these cells indicates that they're probably the ones that are developing the perivascular, inside the brain, infected cells causing inflammation. So very intriguing work. Also from Dr. Bell, where she looked at these macrophages. Monocytes become macrophages when they enter the brain. And you can see in the upper left-hand corner these CD68 staining in heart-treated individuals. The point is really that you see a lot of brown staining. There are a lot of macrophages, even in patients who are well-controlled at the time they die. They had well-controlled viral load in their blood. And on the right, you can see that patients on heart, actually, they can identify these macrophages in the brain, even among patients who are treated with heart. So I think our work is cut out for us to try to figure out ways in which we can attack these reservoirs and try to clear them, perhaps causing some benefit for cognitive impairment. I would be remiss if I didn't mention the point that these antiretrovirals probably don't universally get into the brain. There's great work being done by Scott Latonder and others describing the impact of some of these antiretrovirals on brain penetration. And in fact, you can show that the higher your brain penetration effectiveness of your overall antiretroviral regimen, the more likely you are to have undetectable virus in your CSF. And there's a lot of work that needs to be done to determine the cognitive impact of this. There have been some mixed reports on this, but I think it's an area that requires a lot more work. I thought I'd switch now and talk a little bit about confounding factors. I'm sure I'm running a little bit late on time. We have a model of cognitive impairment that really considers the interactions of a lot of comorbid illnesses. We're worried a bit about chronic immune activation that occurs even in the setting of well-controlled HIV. We're worried about the long-term complications of antiretrovirals, particularly the cardiovascular and cerebrovascular effects and how they may impact the brain. Some of the work that we've done in Honolulu shows nothing that is surprising to this audience, but hypertension is much more frequent, smoking is much more frequent, and in fact, during the time when we were evaluating these patients, we had about 20 deaths, and about 20% of them were cardiovascular deaths. So we think there's significant outcomes with regard to these factors, and it's likely that they're affecting the brain as well. If you look at the number of these risk factors, diabetes, smoking, high cholesterol, and hypertension, and just count the number that people have, you can see in this graph that performance on a neuropsychological test is worse with the more, with a greater number of these factors that you have. So we think there's a clear correlation. In the multicenter AIDS cohort study of the MACs, they found that carotid intimal thickness in the neck correlates to cognitive outcomes. I don't have enough time to go into a lot of the other confounding and comorbid illnesses, but I would also be remiss not to mention factors such as psychiatric conditions, co-infections, principally hepatitis C, and also illicit drug use. These are, in some cases, modifiable factors. So are the cerebrovascular risk factors. Things that you as patients can do and you as doctors can recommend. Stop smoking, get exercise, treat diseases when they present. Be very aggressive about treating depression and psychiatric illness. So there are clearly some things that can be done. Let me switch quickly to the aging point and then I'll close up. We began studying HIV and aging a long time ago in Hawaii. On the right side of your screen, you can see me in my Aloha shirt back when I was a physician in Hawaii in 2003 on the front page of the Advertiser, studying patients who were over 50 years of age living with HIV. And I don't need to remind this audience that we're dealing with aging in all organ disease systems, not necessarily just the brain. If you look at the prevalence of dementia in a population that does not have HIV, it increases exponentially with increasing age. So in younger ages, you don't see a lot of cognitive impairment. And as you get over 90 years of age, about half of the people will have some form of dementia. So this is an exponential increase. There was an intriguing report that came out of St. Louis by Bo Ancis this year suggesting that the brain metabolic rate may be accelerated as much, or decreased rather, as much as 15 years in HIV. And if this is any indication that patients with HIV may be at higher risk for some of these non-HIV dementia syndromes, and if you just increase this curve by 15 years, there's a grand possibility that we might see very high levels of cognitive impairment once we start studying people who are 70, 80, or older years of age. I'll concentrate on just one protein, but again, Eliezer Masli has pointed out in some nice work that he's done that we see increased deposition of a number of proteins. Oh, my time is up. I'll have to go just quickly through these last points. A number of proteins, alpha-synuclein, which is associated with Parkinson's disease, TDP-43, but amyloid, and there's a wide range of evidence suggesting that there may be alterations in amyloid accumulation and degradation in the brains of patients with HIV. And in fact, in limited studies that looked at it, we see CSF amyloid levels that appear to pattern similar to Alzheimer's disease in HIV patients who are impaired. The good news, though, is when we image for amyloid in the brain using a new Pittsburgh compound, there's no evidence that there's fibrillary amyloid, at least in younger people with good control. And I don't know where this will go in terms of older people and whether the amyloid that's building up will eventually fibrillate and cause fibrillary plaques. Also, the damage to the synapse I mentioned before is likely reversible. So we've got some good news. Moreover, in our cohort of people over 60 years of age, you can look at our poster up on Wednesday this week, about half of people test perfectly normal on cognitive tests. So the rate does not seem to be terribly accelerated, but these are people between 60 and 70 years of age. So my closing slides, where do we go from here? First of all, I think HIV cognitive impairment is a silent epidemic. Although dementia is rare, I think milder impairment are present. Many patients adopt compensatory means to get by, but work is needed to identify people with impairment and identify treatment options. HIV appears to be inadequately treated using our existing regimens. Sequestered reservoirs appear to be active in some way, and I'm particularly concerned about monocytes, but I think chronic immune activation, even in T cells, may be particularly concerning. As well, I'm not sure the data with regard to penetration needs to be clarified, and the degree to which this is going to affect cognitive impairment needs to be assessed a little bit more. Finally, confounding factors are very important to consider in HIV patients. Doctors should address these carefully. Patients should remain physically and cognitively stimulated. Physical exercise, I think, cannot be overstated. Although there are no direct evidence, the evidence in non-HIV cognitive impairment seems to be getting stronger and stronger, and also will help prevent some of the modifiable factors. There are theoretical concerns for increased emergence of cognitive problems, disorders in older HIV patients, but there's too much unknown at this time, and a lot of research is needed. I want to thank the people who funded all this work, particularly the NIH, NIMH, NIA, the Larry Hillblum Foundation, Cecilia Shakuma and Bruce Shermisu, who do a lot of the HIV DNA work, Jintana Ananorwich in Bangkok and her team, who've done a lot of the work there, and Bruce Miller at the Memory and Aging Center. Thank you. Sorry I went over.
Thank you very much. An excellent talk. I think we can take one or two questions if we hurry. Any questions from the microphone? Let me just ask you, you've made a good case for this being an active process, and yet there are some data suggesting that it's the nadir CD4 that is strongly predictive of dysfunction, and that if you start early enough, you don't see this, so which would argue the opposite. So how do you put those two lines of evidence together?
So the data on CD4 nadir are actually been shown by several different groups, including our group. I think we published one of the first papers on CD4 nadir and cognition. I think it may be a little bit naive to just assume that that means if you treat early that you're going to protect from this, because there are so many confounding issues related to CD4 nadir. Many of the people with very low nadirs were exposed to different medications. They may have had a prolonged period of time where they weren't treated. Now, in the current era, we may be talking about treating at 350, 500 versus 200. I don't think there's sufficient data to draw those conclusions based on the nadir. But you're absolutely right. There is a very strong correlation, reproducible correlation with the nadir count. But I think it's a bit more complex.
So what's your take on who should be tested by detailed neuropsychological testing?
Unfortunately, it's difficult to get neuropsychological testing. To do the types of batteries that are done in research studies requires a lot of time. And I was speaking about this last night. I really wish I had the answer with regard to what screening tool we could use. There's an HIV dementia scale. There's a Montreal cognitive assessment test. There are some bedside screens that can be done. Many doctors begin to think about the mini mental status exam because they know it's really a lousy test for this disease, and I wouldn't recommend using it. Who should be screened is going to be a feasibility issue. If 50% of the patients who come into your clinic could have a disease, wouldn't you want to screen everyone? So it's a feasibility issue. I think we need to figure out a way to make this work.
All right. Well, I really want to appreciate thank the speakers for all the four excellent talks for the audience. We've certainly answered some questions, but I think left a lot of questions unanswered for future conferences. So thank you all for your attention.